We're looking tonight just within this chapter in the book, and this really is some of the background issues pertaining to David and Solomon's kingdoms. We start David around 1000 BC, and the years are not always this precise, but sometimes they're pretty close. We equate Saul's reign to about 40 years, David's reign to about 40 years, Solomon's reign to about 40 years. And so 1000 to 960 is the reign of David, and then 960 to 920, the reign of Solomon. And so we're looking at about an 80-year window of time. The monarchy, the united monarchy of Israel, Israel as a united nation, lasted for 120 years. Saul, David, Solomon, 120 years, and that's it until the Maccabean Revolt, whenever Israel regained its independence from Rome for a brief window of time under the Maccabees. And so for all we have about the history of Israel, it was not nearly as much a kingdom of Israel as we would think. Now it existed as a divided kingdom for much longer, but as a united monarchy, wasn't that very long. And David and Solomon's reigns are roughly two-thirds of that time period. We talked last week, and I don't know how well you can see, probably better if you have a copy of it, or even if you have any kind of Bible map, if you got a Bible app on your tablet or any kind of map that shows you the region of Israel. This, in large part, is Solomon's building activities, but I wanted you to see this area here where Megiddo is located is the Jezreel Valley. It's the primary cut through on the western mountains. And then you move down, Jerusalem is going to be, I can't see right here. Megiddo here, Jerusalem here, and then south you see the city of Arad. A little further north, I believe right here, is the city of Hazor. The city of Beit Shan is going to be down here. These are some of the key names, locations that would be built up and fortified during Solomon's reign. They're also locations that we'll visit on the Israel trip, or if you ever go on an Israel trip. Arad is a common stop. Megiddo is a common stop. Hazor is not. I don't think it is. I don't think it's on our itinerary this year. But those two, and I've got a video just to give you an idea of what an archaeological site at a tell looks like. We're going to look at an aerial of Tell Arad tonight. Very, very different than whenever you're looking at archaeological work that's being done in an occupied city like Nazareth, Jerusalem, Caesarea, places that are still functioning cities. That's obviously one of the tough things about doing archaeological work in Jerusalem is it's much bigger than it used to be. It's still occupied, lots of businesses, roads, homes. Also, Jerusalem was built on ridges going up a mountain. And Jerusalem was torn down and rebuilt and torn down and rebuilt and conquered and rebuilt and conquered and rebuilt many times. And so it makes it a little bit tougher to do quite the exhaustive archaeological work there that that you would find in some other places. If you're looking on this map, see if you can identify the city of Hebron. If you find Jerusalem and just trace that road south, you'll come to the city of Hebron. Probably on here, it's about there. Jerusalem here, Hebron here. Hebron would be David's capital city for the first 7 years of his reign. He was from the tribe of Judah, was born in Bethlehem. This was in his backyard, so to speak, and Hebron was a nice fortified area, a good place from which to reign, but the problem David had, if you remember his story early on, was many of the northern tribes wanted to follow one of the sons of King Saul, Ish-bosheth, who set up a capital, a second capital, in He's in the Transjordan area. I don't recall exactly the name of the town, but on this map, it's going to be over in the vicinity of Rabbah. Ishbosheth sets up a capital over here. And the first several years of David's reign, there was some debate over who was the real king. Should it be a descendant of Saul, Ishbosheth, or should it be a son-in-law of Saul? Remember, David very carefully navigated a marriage to one of Saul's daughters, Michal. This was not his preferred wife. Bathsheba would become his preferred wife in time, but Michal remained. She was the one that would accuse David, that accused David when he came home dancing in front of the parade, accused him of playing the part of a fool. Their relationship was not necessarily a warm one, but it was a very strategic one, politically speaking, because it gave David a dynastic right to the throne. But right from the very beginning, there was a lot of contention over who should be the next king. David taking the city of Jerusalem would be one of his most significant and most brilliant maneuvers, because the city of Jerusalem had yet to be taken by Israel up to this point, and it was a city that belonged to none of the 12 tribes. It didn't belong to Judah the way Hebron did. It didn't belong to Benjamin. It didn't belong to Ephraim. It didn't belong to any of the tribes. And so, much like the District of Columbia for us, it was a neutral city that all 12 tribes could identify as their capital. And then not only did David manage to conquer the city, but the Ark of the Covenant, which had been kind of relegated to some tabernacle in the south, Kiriath Jearim perhaps, maybe Kadesh Barnea, I don't recall specifically, somewhere in the southern reaches of the country, David has the Ark of the Covenant brought to the city of Jerusalem, builds a tabernacle there for it. And so not only do you have centralized government for the 12 tribes now in a neutral place, but you also have a centralized place for their religion to call home, for the cult of the Israelites to call home. These were very, very important political maneuvers for David. The city of Jerusalem, archaeological record, what has been excavated goes back. People believe that it was inhabited as far back as 3500 BC. That's far, far, far prior to Abraham coming as a wandering nomad through the region. 3500 BC, the first possible appearance of it in the Bible is when Abraham meets Melchizedek, the king of Salem, king of Salem. Many scholars believe that's a reference to Jerusalem, that city perched right there in the western mountains, kind of in a strategic location. And so it was in the hands of different tribes, Melchizedek being a king. It's mentioned there later on. Around the time of the conquest, it's usually identified as being occupied by a group of people called the Jebusites. And Joshua and the followers, the generations after him, were not able to remove the Jebusites from the city of Jerusalem. You'll notice most of the really large cities, the more influential cities, are close to either the Mediterranean Sea, all the Philistine cities are there, all the Phoenician cities are there, or they're located much more closer to the Jordan River Valley, either on the Sea of Galilee. Later on, Capernaum is going to be there. Hazor is just north of there. Jericho, much closer to the Jordan River. Remember, in the ancient world, cities had to be close to water, And so for a major city to be in the middle of the country, 16 miles to the Dead Sea one direction, 36 miles to the Mediterranean Sea the other direction, perched up in the top of the mountains, there had to have been a water source. And so there was. There was a source referred to as the Gihon Spring, and tunnels that fed water from the Gihon Spring inside the fortified walls of Jerusalem. According to the biblical account, it's believed this is what David's military commanders used in order to access the city and to go through the tunnel and climb up and get into the city. Even today, most archaeologists and scholars look at the tunnels leading up from the Gihon Spring and they say that's nearly impossible to accomplish. It had to have been some kind of feat of you know, incredible strength, incredible skill in order for one or two or several men to be able to get up that, you know, that cistern, so to speak, and get into the city. But that's part of the reason why the city was never taken up until that point. Let's go back to the video. This is kind of a 3D rendering, and the guy's going to talk over it. It's 10 minutes. We're only going to watch about 2.5. I want you to see kind of the landscape of Old Jerusalem and how it sits. What you're going to notice is it looks like two little spurs, elevated spurs that kind of come together. And there's three valleys, one on the east, one on the west, and one that kind of cuts down the middle. The old city of Jerusalem is going to rest on the eastern spur. The Kidron Valley will be on one side. The Teropian Valley, the western spur, and the Hinnom Valley on the other side. Eventually, all of that stuff in the middle is going to become part of Jerusalem as Jerusalem grows and expands and builds. But the original city of Jerusalem just sat on the southern edge of this eastern spur. You'll see, if you have a book, I think there's a map that shows some of this. I'll look for it while... Oh, it's on page 111, map 56. And then once David takes the city, they kind of build north to the Temple Mount and encompass a larger part of that eastern ridge in order to expand the city. And so this video is going to show some 3D renderings of the original city and then David taking it and then them expanding and building around for Solomon's temple and his palace. So click play on there, Mike, and we'll watch about 2.5-3 minutes, and then I'll tell you when to... I may have you pause it, too, so keep a close trigger finger on the pause button.
Solomon's temple stood in Jerusalem for almost 400 years. It was the crown jewel of Jerusalem and the center of worship to the Lord. Almost half of the Old Testament writings took place during the time when Solomon's temple was still standing. Understanding the significance of its location, history, and design can greatly add to one's reverence for one of the most holy places in the world. The city of Jerusalem is located in an area of three major valleys, the Hinnom, the Central or Teropian, and the Kidron Valley. The mountain range between the Central and Kidron Valley is called Mount Moriah. The peak of the mountain is a large, protruding, flat rock, which is now located under the Dome of the Rock. According to Genesis 22:2, Abraham was commanded to sacrifice Isaac in the region of Moriah, connecting the Temple Mount with this significant event. At the time of King David, the area of Jerusalem was controlled by the Jebusites, the city only occupying the southern part of the central ridge.
Right, pause there, Mike. So it's just in picture form what I talked about a while ago. The Kidron Valley here, if you're thinking about most of the pictures that you see of the Temple Mount today and the Dome of the Rock are taken from the Mount of Olives. And the Mount of Olives is going to be across the Kidron Valley to the east, looking back towards the west. And so now modern-day Jerusalem is, I mean, it's... you know, a large bit of this. We think of Jerusalem as this major mega world city. You'll see if you travel there, if you've been or if you're going, what's referred to this original old little spot, it's about 10 acres of land, is referred to today as the City of David. By calling it the City of David, we're identifying that as the original Jerusalem that David captured before a lot of the Israelite expansion began. And so 10 acres of land on the southern edge, but you'll see, I don't know if it shows in this video, if you see pictures, you can imagine, not only do you have walls, but from every angle, if you're an invading army trying to take the city, you're fighting up rocky hills to get to the base of the wall to then try and get up on top of the walls. It didn't have to be well armed. It was a perfect location for fortification and made it, that's why Israel had such a hard time taking it. You see the Kidron Valley here, that's a name that's recognized a lot in the Bible. The Hinnom Valley on this side, In the New Testament, that's where a lot of the language for language and imagery for hell originates. When New Testament writers refer to hell or the place of punishment as Gehenna, Gehenna was the Valley of Hinnom. That was kind of the garbage dump, so to speak. It's where refuse or leftover, you know, sacrificed animals or garbage would be taken. Not during David's time, but during Jesus' time, Roman era Jerusalem. And so that's this Hinnom Valley that's over here on the western side. Okay, play again.
When David captured the city in about 1000 BC, he made Jerusalem his capital. David then moved the Ark of the Covenant to Jerusalem and began preparations for building a permanent structure to replace the portable tabernacle of Moses that had been used for over 400 years. With the ancient city of Jerusalem being fairly small, David purchased the threshing floor of Arona the Jebusite so he could expand the size of the city. Being higher than the city of David, the hilltop would make a beautiful place to build the temple of the Lord. Under the reign of David's son, King Solomon, the temple construction began. After 7 years of construction in about 960 BC, Solomon finished building the temple, most likely built over the same protruding rock of Mount Moriah. Solomon also built himself a new palace just south of the temple and expanded the walls of the city up towards the peak of Mount Moriah.
All right, pause there. See if you can back up on the meter just a couple of seconds. There you go. So, a lot of people like to make much more of Mount Moriah, like there's a single rock or a single place. And in Jewish tradition, they believed they could identify it. The commentator on the video did a nice job saying God sent Abraham to the region of Moriah. And so we don't know exactly the place where Abraham took Isaac. This happens to be a flat rock that's at a, you know, particularly high place. And so it's oftentimes considered to be that, although we don't know for sure. This is just like, you know, when you go visit any ancient site, they'll say, oh, this is where David fought Goliath, and this is where, you know, Moses saw the burning bush. And in fact, there's the burning bush right here. We have a gift shop, and you can buy twigs off of the burning bush to take home with you. And we don't know exactly, but the location is correct. I mean, from a regional point of view, around about here, the region of Moriah. And the temple was chosen. David and Solomon wanted to build the temple over that place, believing that it had significance going back to Abraham, the account, the binding of Isaac with Abraham and Isaac. And so 250 feet is the elevation gain from the city of David up to where the temple would be built. It's not a huge gain. If you've ever done any hiking, you know, in the mountains, 250 feet is not a huge gain, but it did make for a higher place than the original city and made for a great location, they believed, to build the temple of the Lord. And of course, he also mentioned, once you get the temple of the Lord built, then Solomon had to build his own palace, and he also had built a lot of other things, including a palace for a couple of his wives. He went on a huge building campaign, extending the walls around the city. And so you see the city kind of gets this little oblong oval feel as it moves up the eastern spur, not wanting to venture down into either one of the valleys just yet. But the city, even after Solomon, the city will continue to expand and grow throughout the Old Testament period, especially moving into the Roman period. So hit it again, Mike.
Walls of the city up towards the peak of Mount Moriah. The Temple of Solomon was modeled after the Tabernacle of Moses. Because of the many similarities between the Tabernacle and the Garden of Eden, many scholars believe that the Garden
there.
Of Eden...
We won't go into great detail on the Temple. You travel to Israel today, the Temple Mount. There's even debate on where the exact location of the Temple was located, because currently, it's believed to be under the Dome of the Rock, which is obviously a very significant holy place for the Islamic faith, and creates a lot of tension because the Jewish people would love to rebuild a temple on that exact spot, but that doesn't come without a lot of fighting. There's some conspiracy theories that say that the original location of Solomon's temple wasn't where the Dome of the Rock is, but is somewhere else there on the Temple Mount region. I tend not to spend a great deal of time and energy studying those things because I'm not so convinced that a rebuilding of the temple, of what would be a third temple, is necessary for a lot of the events of Revelation to take place. A lot of prophecy news watchers are convinced that that is the case, that we're waiting on the temple to be rebuilt before the end times will be ushered in. So what I wanted you to see mainly in that video is kind of the landscape of the city of Jerusalem. We looked at, we watched a video last week on the modern city of Jerusalem and, you know, how it just looks, you know, I mean, it really is significantly different than it used to be. The map, if you've got map 56, Jerusalem in the time of David and Solomon, this is the one I mentioned on page 56. The altitude of Jerusalem, I believe, is in the 2,500 feet above sea level. So it is not Denver, Colorado, mile high. But when you consider that you're at sea level 36 miles that way, and you're 200 feet below sea level 16 miles that way, 2,500 feet up is a pretty good elevation gain for not that many miles traveled. But you see a lot of the topography there. You see the Mount of Olives located on that map. When we get to the time of Jesus, that journey from the old city where the Temple Mount was located down in the Kidron Valley, down one side, up on the other, on that upswing, as soon as you get down the valley and start climbing up the Mount of Olives is the Garden of Gethsemane, up the Mount of Olives and over to the other side towards Bethany, which is where the home was that he stayed. That's the pathway and a lot of that in and out that Jesus would have spent his final week there in Jerusalem. So, questions thus far, comments, observations or memories about visit to the old city of Jerusalem? It's not, yeah.
The valleys here are just little indentions.
Yeah.
Just a few hundred feet wide.
Yeah.
So it's not this massive valley like the valley in California where it's miles and miles and miles and miles. It's just
right.
A crevice.
Yeah.
And it was given an identifier called a valley.
Yeah.
Just a few hundred feet width.
Yeah. The comment there was these valleys, sometimes by what we identify as valleys here in the U.S., are much smaller scale, both in altitude gain, but also in how far they run. On this topographical map, you go down to 2,100 feet, you go down to 2,000 feet. So down to 2,000 feet from, 2,500. I mean, a 500 foot gain is not insignificant, but this is, it's. Yeah, the width is what?
1/8 of a mile.
Yeah.
Right,
right, right. Yeah. Well, and again, I mean, if you've seen pictures of the Dome of the Rock or some of those where it looks like there's a cemetery here, and then you can kind of look down the cemetery and then see the Temple Mount and the Dome of the Rock up on the other side. That's the Kidron Valley. I mean, that cemetery is sitting up on the eastern side of the Kidron Valley. You're looking down. Do we have Mike? See if you can track down a picture there. I know we had that Jerusalem video from a week ago. Actually, page 114. Yeah. I mean, that's it. That is the Kidron Valley. You're looking from the Mount of Olives. This old cemetery that's there, those trees down at the bottom, the Garden of Gethsemane will be down in those trees, and then up the other side towards... Now, that wall around the old city of Jerusalem has been rebuilt and rebuilt and rebuilt, and you will see some limestone and some different carved, you know, blocks that look like they go back, or they're believed to go back to the Roman period, and maybe even some that are later than that. A lot of the wall has been... is Ottoman, I believe. Stephen, do you recall? Ottoman Empire, 1500s maybe? Yeah. So, but yeah, Kidron Valley is, I mean, Ken's estimate there by looking at the map is about an eighth of a mile, quarter of a mile, and that's, it's not much, but from a fighting war point of view, it was enough back in those days. Yeah. Yeah.
That's a pretty good climb.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. His comment there, a 500-foot gain in, really it'd be less than half a mile. I mean, because that's a 500-foot gain in half of that Kidron Valley. So you're talking maybe a 500-foot gain in a 16th of a mile, maybe?
Well, but you probably had to walk 3 miles to get that half a mile.
Yeah.
Because
snaking back and forth. Yeah.
When we visited a long time ago, 1969, we went to Hebron, just south of Jerusalem, where Sarah is buried. And along comes a gentleman who said that he was in charge of the Muslims of the city. He was very angry at the Israelites for their army possessing his city. That's all I remember about it. But he was quite upset.
Right.
He wanted us to be upset too.
Right. If you track the history of the land, it's been occupied by so many different people for such lengthy periods of time. That's part of the problem. And you know, as long as all of them stay independent and they all independently have a claim on the land, you know, how many, I mean, look, if all of the Native American tribes wanted to each, you know, come up and claim their rights to their land, you know, the benefit that we have in the U.S. is so many immigrant peoples have come here and we've all kind of blended together into one American citizenship in large part, and the voices of many of the Native American tribes have been minimized so much they don't have a claim to it. But you still have vestiges of Philistines. That's where the Palestinians come from. You've got vestiges of Canaanites. You got vestiges of a variety of Islamic faith peoples from the time of the Ottomans. You've obviously got the Jewish presence. You've got Christian presence during the Roman Empire. Christian presence, you know, it's, and so the old city today is divided into four areas called the four quarters, and you have the Jewish quarter, you have the Muslim quarter, you have the Catholic quarter, and the Orthodox quarter, Armenian, yeah. So, and they are noticeably distinct. When you walk into different parts of the old city, you can tell when you're entering into the Muslim quarter, when you're entering into the Catholic or the Christian quarter, because they all, even though they all don't have possession of the land, they all still have a place. They have territory there in the center of the old city of Jerusalem to, as a home for, you know, for their system of faith. Page 106 is map 53. Mike, this is the map that's got the kingdom of David and Solomon on it. I just wanted you to notice David was the warrior, Solomon was the builder. And so he conquered. That's a small map, but yeah. He conquered the Jebusites. He never really defeated the Philistines, but he eliminated the Philistine threat. And he took over the region of the Shephelah, which is the foothills, kind of between the western mountains and the coastal plain where the Philistines lived. He went over into the Transjordanian region and pretty much subjugated the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Edomites. And look how far north. I mean, once you get past Mount Hermon, which is not on this map. Mount Hermon. Once you get north of, is Dan on this map? Oh, Dan is on this map. I mean, you see, Dan is located right at the southern edge, right here. This right here is about where modern-day Israel, the northern borders of modern-day Israel, are located. And once you get north of that, you're into Lebanon and Syria. So you see the city of Damascus on that map. David extended up into the Aramean. This is the region of the Arameans. All the way down into practically to Egypt on the far side of the Jordan River, as far east as the Mediterranean was west. David was the military leader, expander. I mean, this is not Napoleon, so to speak. This is not Alexander the Great. But as far as Israel goes, this is as much of an Alexander the Great kind of era in their history as you would have. And that they started off with just this tiny little area where the 12 tribes are located, and David began expanding the kingdom of Israel. Of course, much like with Alexander the Great, when he died, there wasn't anybody that was a strong enough ruler to keep all that territory together. David, when David dies, Solomon becomes king, and he does a lot of building, a lot of negotiating, a lot of politicizing, but he can't hold the 12 tribes together. And after Solomon dies, the kingdom split. But I did want you to see how David's kingdom extends into modern-day Jordan, extends into modern-day Lebanon, extends into modern-day Syria. And if it doesn't extend into modern-day Egypt, it goes right up to the border of Egypt. David, for 40 years, he centralized the government, he centralized the religion, and that unified the 12 tribes. This was golden era. He also subjugated all of their enemies. So Solomon becomes king, and he didn't have any wars to fight because David had fought them all. And whenever you're not having to spend all of your money and resources building tanks and guns and submarines and airplanes, then you can funnel all your resources and manpower into doing what? Building infrastructure, building roads, building buildings, building cities, building education, building culture, art and museums, and writing your history. And so Solomon comes into, Solomon's stereotype of being wise and being a lover of the arts and, you know, being kind of a, David was a man's man. You know, he was very much a fighter, kind of a brute. God said, you can't build the temple because you've got so much blood on your hands. Solomon comes in and he's very much, you know, the thespian, the artist, the creative mindset. Maybe that's who he was anyways. Maybe it was a perfect storm of him being that kind of leader at a time when he had all the money, all the resources, all the freedom to completely immerse himself and Israel into this 40 years of, you know, a golden age of building. And so they build the temple. He builds his own palace. He builds a palace for one of his wives who happened to be the daughter of the Pharaoh of Egypt. Pharaohs of Egypt didn't give their daughters in marriage to foreign dignitaries. That speaks to how powerful Israel had become and how influential Solomon was. He builds up and fortifies Jerusalem, but then he also went around Israel and built up greater fortifications around a handful of cities. The city of Megiddo was one of them, one of Solomon's fortified cities. The city of Arad was another of Solomon's fortified cities, because he didn't just want Jerusalem to be the only fortified location. If you've got outside invaders coming, he wanted to stop them at Hazor in the north, or he wanted to be able to stop them at Arad in the south, or from wherever it was that they were coming, building fortified cities in all these locations. The other video, Mike, is this is Looks like somebody who lives in Israel that just got their drone and went out and took some aerial footage of a bunch of different sites in Israel. This one in particular that he just does flying over Tel Arad. And you'll see, this is, if we were to go from Jerusalem north, you see a lot of green, a lot of rain, a lot more farming, a lot more vineyards. You go Jerusalem south, you're moving more towards the Negev, more and more towards the Sinai Desert. And notice what the landscape looks like. Go ahead and hit play. You can turn the volume down. This is just like goofy piano music. Apparently his name is Brad. And he has designated this as Brad TV. But I like the idea because it gives you a better scope, both of the area, but also what one of these ancient sites looks like when it's not surrounded by a modern city. What archaeologists are dealing with when they're out in the middle of nowhere. And Arad is really a nice location because you can kind of see the city wall, you can see the streets, you can see some of the, you know, the outline of the buildings. You have a city in one part, and then you've got kind of a fortified fortress area up on a higher promenade right there near the city. So he comes across this direction, you see the city here, and then you'll see the fort or the fortress here. And that's, I mean, that's what these cities look like. I mean, they weren't terribly big. They didn't have just a ton of people. I mean, a lot of people would live in those areas, but then people would live out in the areas, would farm. And this is southern area from Jerusalem. Here again, you see the town here. Go up this road to that fortress area up here. This, of course, is all modern buildings for tourists. You know, your check-in, your Israeli antiquities authority. Here again, the fortress that's up there on the hill. Nice square wall built around it. Of course, modern road runs right next to it now. And look how the layers, I mean, this is what they talk about when we talk about a tell. It's a city that was built up and then probably destroyed and built up and built up and built up. And over time, they, of course, wanted the most fortified part of the city to be at the highest elevation they could. And so that being one of Solomon's fortified areas. I mean, it looks like desert, just straight up. But notice over here, that big green patch in the back. Modern Israel has done a really, really nice job of intelligent irrigation and farming. And so they've been able to turn parts of that desert area into arable, you know, land that they're able to use. Just about anywhere you go in the country, if you go to restaurants, hotels, they'll tell you 95%, 98%, something ridiculous. The amount of food that's consumed in Israel is grown in Israel. They don't import food very much. They export food. They grow enough in that country to feed their country and then to export to other places. And so it feels almost prophetic, you know, that deserts are turned into fields. Very much, you know, a sense of land of milk and honey. So, anyways, that's Tel Arad. Thanks, Mike. A lot of those, that other map we started with, Solomon's building activities, you know, mentions, oh, it's got the little green boxes around fortified cities. Arad, Beersheba is another one that's usually on most of the tours. Gezer is not on the tour. But Gezer has recently been excavated by an archaeological professor who was at New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary when I started my degree there. Hurricane Katrina chased him out of New Orleans, and he went to Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth. He's been the lead archaeologist that's been excavating at Tel Gezer for the last decade or more. So Beth Horon, and then you go up north, Megiddo, and up further north, Hatzor. Solomon had lots of money because they monopolized the trade routes coming through their part of the land. Had lots of good relationships. The Queen of Sheba, which is identified most likely with Where do we identify Queen of Sheba? Maybe Arabian Peninsula, perhaps. I was thinking of Cush. Cush is identified with the ancient area that's modern Ethiopia, further south of Egypt. He had interactions with a lot of foreign dignitaries and became very wealthy, built up Israel a great deal. The problem was, after he died, the Israelite people had had enough. They didn't want to keep building. Solomon built all of these things. They didn't have slave labor, so they used their own people. It was pretty commonplace, if you were an Israelite citizen, to give up as much as half of your year to the government to go work on the king's projects instead of at home tending to your own farms, your own family. And people were willing to do that for a while, but after years and years and years and years of doing that, it kind of wore itself out. And after Solomon's death, his son Rehoboam, the people came and said, we don't want to do this anymore. We're not going to follow you if you're going to keep doing things the same way Solomon did. And the king did not listen to them, and so 10 tribes split from the two southern tribes. A lot of history moving forward, when we get to next week and we start looking at the divided kingdoms. Once the kingdoms divide, one of the biggest challenges, as much as Jerusalem and the temple became a unifying force for monarchy Israel, whenever the kingdoms divided, now we've got 10 tribes in the north that don't have a capital and don't have a temple, because Jerusalem and the Temple of Solomon are in the south. They're in the land controlled by the southern kingdom of Judah. And so the northern kingdom of Israel will have to do a lot of work identifying, and their capital will move around. Instead of having one holy place, they'll set up two or three. And a lot of their history through that divided, that period of the divided kingdom is built around their capital and their religion being homeless, so to speak, because they lost access to what previously was their central place. Anything there? Arad, Megiddo, fortified cities. Any of you guys that have been before? Anything memorable or?
I keep remembering Masada.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Masada is a very memorable location, and we do visit that. Masada's significance comes after the time of Jesus. It's around the Roman destruction of the Second Temple, and so late first century AD. It doesn't factor into the biblical account. Very, very significant in Jewish history. And so there's a little bit of it's a really remarkable site with a remarkable story to go along with it. It's one of the cooler things that you see when you go to Israel. It just doesn't have any influence in the Hebrew Bible or the Christian New Testament. It's a part of Israel's, their national heritage. I've told people there are lots on the Israel trip that are fantastic. And some of the most intriguing things that you see have nothing to do with the Bible. And Masada is one of them, and Petra is the other. They have ties. They have ties to the biblical accounts. But those are both really remarkable. So what you see at Masada is very similar from a landscape, from a landscape and a ruins point of view, is very similar to what you see here. Because it's newer, it's a little bit more built up. It is the relief on how high up that is remarkable. And we will look at the Masada and the story of that when we get close to the end of the course later in the semester. We're going to look at that. We're going to look at some of the dynamics between the different religions, between Roman Catholicism in Israel, the Orthodox faith, Orthodox Christianity in Israel, some of those religious dynamics. If you're not used to Catholicism and Orthodoxy, you go in these, that's the Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church are the ones that have built up all of these shrines and monuments and locations. And it can be really, really striking for Protestants who don't identify with a lot of the iconography, with the use of the incense, with some of those practices of worship. Very different, you know, culturally and religious experiences than what Protestants in America, how we identify Christianity. And so we're going to look at some of those other surrounding elements when we get close to the end of the course.